from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I am Roger McDonough, and today on the show, how Utah political and religious leaders reacted to the family separations at the U.S.-Mexico border, and what they might make of the planned indefinite detention of families together. Also, Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes has a conflict of interest that would appear to disqualify him from the Inland Port Board he appointed himself to. Plus, political upheaval in San Juan County, recommendations from a state commission looking at guns and schools, and more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. Welcome, George.
Good morning.
Government and politics editor Dan Harry is here as well. Welcome to you.
Morning.
And on the phone, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Tommy, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Good morning.
And as always, you can join us with your thoughts on the stories that we are covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us. We're at 801-355-8255. Dominating the headlines this week were stories about increasing backlash over the Trump administration policy that separated families at the U.S.-Mexico border. And then on Wednesday, an announced change to that policy. Thomas Burr, you've been covering this from Washington. There was growing unease with what was going on, and this kind of came to a head this week. And it had to do with some recent changes in border policy and enforcement along the border. Maybe a quick recap of what this policy was before we turn our attention to how Utah reacted to it.
Sure, it's a bit complex, but let's just go back in history a little bit. So essentially, if you cross the border without documentation, you're committing a crime. It's a misdemeanor, but it's still a crime. And in past administrations, and up until a few months ago, essentially the policy was, especially for those seeking asylum, that they would be, you know, maybe referred for prosecution, but then released while their case is adjudicated. That lasted until about, I think it was April, when Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a zero-tolerance policy that would say that if you, you know, cross the border without documentation, you committed a crime, you're going to jail while you wait for, you know, a judge to decide on the case. And that resulted, of course, if you're crossing your family, you have a couple little kids, they can't put the little kids, well, I guess they can, but in this case they didn't, they could. It took the little kids away and put the parents in jail in a different facility. Now there's been, what, 2,300 since this policy, 2,300 kids have been separated since this policy was announced. And this is in some ways, the Attorney General even said it, you know, just recently that in some ways that if we, you know, build the wall, then there wouldn't be this problem. And then some critics have said this is using kids as bargaining chips to try to get funding for a border wall.
Yeah, and in the meantime, so as you said, separating kids from parents and then holding, you know, the kids themselves in de facto detention facilities also. That policy has changed, or I don't know, maybe it's in the process of changing, and we're going to get to that. But first, it kind of took us a little while to realize that this was indeed the policy, that families were being separated. There was some deflection. The administration was obscuring the truth on the origin of the policy. And then we had images from where the children were being held. Also images of separations at the border where kids were being taken away from their parents. And the pressure just began to mount and mount in opposition to this. Some of that pressure came from Utah. And so, Tommy, who, you know, from our congressional delegation was calling out the president on this? And what were they saying?
Well, I think the entire delegation was saying that, you know, this was abhorrent, it was heartbreaking, that we shouldn't be breaking up families, while also saying that we have to uphold the rule of law. Senator Orrin Hatch has been very vocal on this. Representative Mia Love, who is the daughter of immigrants, first-generation American, has been pretty impassioned about this as well. This is something that, you know, the White House has been all over the place on. President Trump has kept blaming a law passed by Democrats that caused this. There is no law, for the record. And Democrats are not in power. The Republicans hold both chambers of Congress and, of course, the White House. The Utah delegation has said they want to do something. They differ on the details, if they're offering details at all. But they do all agree that there should be some legislative fix. Now that's really up in the air because yesterday a hardline bill that would essentially not offer any path to citizenship for the Dreamers, would not stop separation of families. That failed to pass in the House. They were going to try another piece of legislation, but that is now punted to next week, it looks like, because they can't agree on they don't have enough agreement to get to a vote. And then President Trump just tweeted this morning that we should just hold off on doing anything until after the midterms, when he expects a, quote, red wave to bring, you know, more power for Republicans in Congress.
You know, I want to come back around to that, actually, but a question that occurs to me right there is hold off on this until, we'll get to the executive order in just a minute. Dan Harry, I want to bring you in on this for just a quick moment, because Tommy mentioned, you know, a number of members of our congressional delegation expressing some level of opposition to this. And all of the people that he just mentioned are members of the Mormon Church. The church also issued a statement on this, as did the leaders of various faiths here in the state of Utah. And all of them also said, essentially, we need to end this, right?
Yeah, they said what you would expect faith leaders to say, that you shouldn't be ripping kids out of the arms of their parents. I mean, it's pretty common sense stuff that, and you would hope faiths and churches would step forward with this kind of statement, and they did, and they were all pretty united, the LDS Church, the Catholic Church here in Utah, the Lutheran Church, Episcopal Church, you know, and many others. And, you know, that's what you would expect to hear.
Right, sure.
I think you'd expect to hear more from our politicians, too. I think, you know, like Tommy said, Senator Hatch has been working on this. I think mostly he's been working behind the scenes, because he doesn't openly criticize this president. He just doesn't do it. But, you know, we're hoping, we don't know this, but we're hoping that kind of behind the scenes, he is working to end this policy.
Tommy, let's turn to what actually happened on Wednesday. President Trump issues this executive order that is meant to end this policy, but it's actually a little bit more complicated than that, and maybe you can explain what it really does do.
Yeah, and it's almost just a complete 180 from this White House that had been saying for you know, a couple weeks now, that Congress needed to fix this, that there was this law that was making them do this, and they couldn't do this without Congress making a fix to it. And then all of a sudden on Wednesday, the president announced he's going to sign an executive order to solve, you know, temporarily solve the problem. One, he didn't need to sign an executive order. He just needed to call the attorney general and say, stop doing this zero tolerance policy. And then two, what the executive order does isn't releasing these families. It's detaining them together, that essentially now, under this new policy, the people will still be charged, and the kids will be kept with them in some kind of facility, and we're not sure how long they'd be kept together.
Right. There was this decision from a federal court, a rule to not keep kids with or without their families detained for longer than 20 days, and that's part of the question here, is whether or not that rule is going to be ignored or changed.
Sure, and the White House has already, I think, filed some documents with the court to try to change that language, because, yes, there's a 20-day limit under the Flores Agreement and a 2015 decision that you can't keep kids more than 20 days detained, and they're trying to change that because, I mean, I've been to an immigration court. It's been a little while, but, like, they're backed up so far. They don't have enough judges to adjudicate these cases in any kind of quick time frame. So, you know, they could be detained for a long period. But let's also add the fact they don't have the facilities to hold them together in some form, because we're talking about a lot of people, and they're not equipped yet to do that. I mean, we're seeing 10 cities popping up already for these situations, and it's going to be difficult no matter what.
Right. There's talk of housing them on military bases and building new detention facilities, and again, a kind of long period of time that they could be held. George Pyle, editorial voice from Salt Lake Tribune, columnist. There's a few things to comment on here. Your reaction, I guess, to the administration's policy, the zero tolerance policy, yeah. and then to how all of this played out this week.
Yeah. Well, right. One, whenever anybody says zero tolerance, they're wrong. I mean, that's bad. Zero tolerance means zero thinking, means zero consideration. It's a term poorly stolen from engineering. Zero tolerance is bad. It means the machine won't work except under very, very specific conditions. It's, in engineering, zero tolerance is bad. So zero tolerance is always bad. And another thing, I mean, the administration has been just this cascade of lies that's come out of the administration. No, we're not separating children from their parents. Yes, we are, but we have to because of the Democrats. Well, no, we don't. And we really hate to do this, but they're making us do it. And we would have to change the law. No, we don't. And, you know, you don't even know who to be mad at. We gave Orrin Hatch a hard time the other day because he wrote a letter to the Attorney General saying, please don't do this. And our initial reaction was, oh, wow, he wrote a letter. Boy, that'll have them quaking in their boots. Well, I'd go to hell. 2 days later, they say, okay, we reversed the policy. We're not going to separate children from their parents anymore. But they didn't say anything about what they were going to do with the children who are already been separated from their parents.
Right. Families aren't reunited yet.
And they seem to have lost track of them. There's a Politico or the Times or somebody had a quote from an immigration judge saying, what, you mean you didn't even give the parents a piece of paper? I mean, if you go to jail and you have to give them, you know, your wallet and the contents of your pocket, they give you a receipt for that. And you take their children away from them and you don't even give them a piece of paper that says where the children are going to be. I mean, the judges are up in arms. Lawyers from all over the country are flying down to Texas to volunteer their services. Stormy Daniels' lawyer, I can never remember his name. He's just
Avenatti.
Stormy Daniels' lawyer.
Michael Avenatti.
Is going down there and he says there are whistleblowers in ICE and in these detention centers who will report that, as some of them already have, that they're in there telling, you know, siblings that are held together they're not allowed to hug each other. There are reports of the children who are in these facilities being shot up with psychotropic drugs to make them be quiet. And, you know, I don't know how much of this is true, but, you know, once you cross the boundary of taking kids away from their parents, almost anything else is pretty believable. If they'll do that, what won't they do? And the question becomes, for the people who are running this administration, hey, Google, is there any space in Spandau Prison? Because that's where people who would promulgate this kind of regulation belong. Yeah.
Well, and I'm imagining, I mean, just we're talking about also finding new places to house them. The idea of indefinitely detaining kids and their parents, I'm imagining that would see court challenges. And I don't know who to turn that one to. Tommy, have you been covering or following the idea of someone saying, actually, you can't do that? What I'm suggesting here is that probably the end result would be to return to that previous policy, which was kind of what the Trump administration calls catch and release, in which people's immigration cases or asylum cases are heard while they are free.
There's already been lawsuits on this. The ACLU is very strong in this. There's a lot of other groups, especially immigrant right groups, that are going to be suing on this. Because, yes, these people aren't maybe U.S. citizens, but that doesn't mean that the Constitution doesn't apply and the right to a speedy trial is still a right. And you cannot detain them for, you know, a year or something like that while they're waiting for a case, especially in situations where may not be the most hospitable. You know, if you're at an army base living with your family, you can't go work, you can't do the things you maybe want to do. There will definitely be lawsuits, and there's already some filed now.
Yeah, and I don't know if they were smart enough to do this on purpose, but it's like, okay, they were taking children away from their parents. Boy, that really made everybody unhappy. So they said, okay, now we're not going to take children away from their parents anymore. And so is the thinking that everybody now will calm down and say, oh, sure, whatever, as long as you're not taking children away from their parents, we don't care if you lock them up forever in an internment camp. Just don't separate the children from their parents. I mean, George Takei, you know, the actor who as a child was interned with his Japanese-American family, wrote, you know, while this was still happening, he said, well, at least when, you know, we were all interned in prison camps, at least they didn't separate families. You know, and said, you know, all my life I thought I had this horrible story, and now it's like, well, this never happened to me, and now supposedly it's not going to happen anymore. And you wonder if they're this intelligent or if it's just going to happen this way, that they think, well, okay, now that we've stopped doing this war crime, that people will leave us alone, and I would hope that they wouldn't.
Tommy or Dan Harry, is there, you know, you mentioned, Tommy, the fact that there were a couple of bills that were brought forth and then, you know, didn't make very much headway or have been delayed. Is there Does this create a renewed appetite, a new pressure for immigration reform in the immediate term? I mean, that doesn't solve the problem that George is describing here, but can we see renewed action on that?
So in some ways, I would say that the president's actions this week to the executive order and then the policy they're saying they're going to end the zero-tolerance policy, it takes a little of the pressure off of Congress to actually do something, but there's still images and there's still pictures and stories about what's going on that's still dominating the news cycle, which is amazing because nothing really dominates the news cycle for very long sometimes.
Right.
But that's still going to be there. The question is, I mean, if you look at the House right now, the House Republicans can't even get together to find a bill to go forward. Democrats are not going to support, bills that are giving $25 billion to build a wall without some kind of consideration for the Dreamers. And then we talk about the Senate. Republicans hold like a small majority there. They need Democrats to pass any kind of legislation. There doesn't seem to be any effort to make any kind of bipartisan legislation.
This may be a case where I don't ever want to say that the president is right, but the president might be sort of right about one thing. We might have to wait for the next election. And if there is a blue wave, then we'll change the direction. And if there's the red wave that the president expects, if he expects that these things that he's doing will bring him a larger majority in Congress, then we may do the other thing. But it might actually get resolved, and this might be something that will basically be decided at the polls in November.
It requires greater majorities, I guess, in the houses of Congress. Dan Harry, any comment on the sort of appetite or possibility of immigration reform?
Well, I just think Congress is in an impossible situation right now. That the president sort of caused this turmoil, and now he's saying, as Tommy pointed out, let's not waste our time on this. Let's move on to other things. The fact is, there are real people still imprisoned and still trying to, reunite with their children. And I don't think the issue is going away, but I don't see Congress having a solution on this.
Yeah, story's not over by any stretch. And I guess we'll see how court cases play out and what happens with policies and new detention facilities or the rest of it. Tommy Burr, thank you very much for covering this interesting, troubling reporting. Guys, we need to head to a break. When we come back, House Speaker Greg Hughes has a conflict that appears to disqualify him from membership on the Inland Port Board, but rules can be changed. This is Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
In 1992, the case of a girl named Jenny Flores made its way to the Supreme Court.
The point that we find ourselves now at is that we have a situation where the Immigration Service is simply closing its eyes to what's in the best interest of these minors.
The Flores settlement laid the foundation for how the U.S. treats migrant children in detention. Now the Trump administration wants to change it. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us today from 3 to 6:30 with Shalane Smith Needham on Utah Public Radio.
More than 2,000 migrant children have been separated from their families. We'll look at the challenges to bring them back together. Also, a very English scandal. Hugh Grant plays a real British politician who was accused of trying to murder his gay lover.
It's a great part. Whenever there's a contrast between the exterior and the interior, it's always fun.
Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning from 6 to 9 with Kirsten Swanson on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune news editor Dan Harry, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. This is our Friday news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments, 801-355-8255, or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, news and politics editor, a couple of items of news on the planned inland port this week. First, there was a meeting of the board There was news that the board actually kind of met, I guess, or tried to meet. I don't know if that's exactly the way to put it. But then they maybe decided that that meeting wasn't a great idea after all. Can you explain what happened with the first inland port board meeting?
Well, we're trying to sort that out. I think the second story sort of helps explain the first
sure.
story. And the second story is that Greg Hughes, the House Speaker, is on his way out. He is not going to run for re-election again. So he has an appointment authority to this board overseeing what is essentially this vast trade hub that's envisioned out west of the airport, which we now have, you know, dry lake bed that nothing exists on, except there will soon be a prison there. And there will be this giant, as it's envisioned, network of rail and highways for long-haul trucks, and you'd imagine air cargo coming in. Anyway, this is seen as this big, huge economic development project, and Greg Hughes wants to be very much a part of it. He was a mover and shaker to get this legislation passed over the objections of Salt Lake City, by the way, who loses a lot of control over a big part of their city because of this. And then after helping, you know, steer that legislation through, he appointed himself to the board, which raised some eyebrows, but, you know, there's no legal reason why you can't do that. But now there appears that there is a legal reason you can't do that, which is he owns property within 5 miles of the boundaries of this new envisioned port. And under the law that was passed, the law that was basically written in his house that he oversees, that's a conflict of interest, and you can't, and you're disqualified from serving on the board.
Did House Speaker Greg Hughes consult with Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes before he appointed him to see whether or not
I'm not sure that they spoke together about this. It didn't seem like they were communicating very well. So anyway, Taylor Anderson from the Tribune looked up the property records, saw, you know, used some geographic mapping and figured out that this violated the terms of that conflict provision, and called the speaker to interview him, and the speaker called him in and said he had not been aware of this, but he didn't believe that this was a good way to resolve conflicts, and so he wants to change the law.
There was a resignation already from this board for essentially a similar reason. Another member of the board resigned because of conflicts over land.
Senator Don Ipson was appointed by the Senate President, Wayne Niedershauser, and because he owns property that would be within 5 miles of this, he resigned. There really was no public debate about it. He just resigned. So
Speaker Hughes wants to change the law so that he's got the green light to be involved. I mean, essentially, he would have to say what? That there are no conflicts if I own land adjacent to this new development project?
I'm not sure what solution he wants. He just wants to get rid of that 5 mile buffer zone. And he also is pointing, you know, to other members of the board saying, well, he has a conflict and she has a conflict and he has a conflict. We don't know that all of that's true. I think that James Rogers, a member of the Salt Lake City Council, does own property within that. And so that would be an issue as well. And that so this whole thing about the conflict of interest provision is sort of, it looks like now why that a first meeting of the Port Authority Board blew up, and it actually never was an official meeting. The members were not sworn in. Greg Hughes and others didn't turn in their conflict of interest forms. And so it looks like, you know, that was by design that meeting was not held.
A false start for the board meeting.
Very much.
We've talked about how conflicts of interest are disclosed at the state legislature, and Hughes, who, as you mentioned, is leaving the legislature, he sort of lumps all of his potential conflicts under one umbrella on that form, on the state legislature form. Is that?
Yeah, and we've written about this. We wrote about this last year, and he has created a holding company, and so when you look at his conflict of interest disclosure, there's only one company. It's Steelers Holding. You know, he's from Pittsburgh originally, and that's a tribute to his hometown team. But he said it's perfectly legal that he had an attorney do this, and that it makes things a lot more convenient to fill out on the conflict form. Well, yeah, it's convenient for him. It's not convenient for somebody who wants to go to those things, because these are public records, and see what the conflicts might be with the legislation that he sponsors and supports.
You have to draw lines between...
Well, you have to... I mean, it's fairly complicated. You have to go to the corporate licensing arm of the state, and you have to look up these companies and by Greg Hughes's name to see which companies he's affiliated with. And there are quite a few of them out there. We found 10 at least, and I think there are more than that. And they're still licensed with the state. Some of them, their licenses have expired, but their records are still there, including some of the property here close to the Inland Port, which are titled in the name of these companies that have expired. Hmm. So it's kind of a mess.
Hmm. You know, I brought this up once before on the show, but there were some suggestions of conflict of interest when Hughes was on the UTA board, or of potentially having stood to benefit from decisions made by that board on land development projects. I mean, this is a sort of, there's an echo of the past here.
Yeah, there's been a lot of allegations that he had some dealings around some of the transit-oriented development. I don't think any of that has been proven to this point. One thing we do know is that while he was chairman of the UTA board, he formed a company with Kevin Garn, former state legislator, and they were going to do some development work, and apparently the company never got off the ground, but it was a legal entity created. And so, you know, in a legal sense of the term, they were partners in this business. And about that time, Kevin Garn's other business, not the one he'd formed with the speaker, but with another partner, was getting all of these contracts with UTA for the developments around the train stations. Hmm. And so that, you know, that didn't look good. And at the same time, he was doing this disclosure where that company was not reported on his disclosure form. So it raised questions about whether he was trying to hide it or not. He said he was not, that it was simply a legal matter, and his attorney had advised him that for business purposes, this was the way to do it.
Circling back to this, the Inland Port Board, he's drawn flack from some quarters for, you know, having a potential conflict of interest. Not from members of his own party, but from members of a different party.
Yes, the United Utah Party, a fledgling party that is formed last year by Senator Bob Bennett's son, Jim, and Richard Davis, who is a Democrat or a former Democrat from Utah County, and a professor at BYU, political scientist, formed this party last year, and they've fielded quite a few candidates this year. They're trying to be the home for disillusioned Democrats and Republicans who are tired of polarized politics. And they've come out and said, been very critical of the speaker appointing himself to this board, saying that's inappropriate, he should resign.
And they said this before this.
They said before this was discovered, but no. They indicated that, you know, there were indications that he might have a conflict of interest. And but just the fact of appointing yourself to this board, you know, should be a disqualifying factor. And so we really haven't heard much other criticism. Now, we are talking to the governor's office, and while not overtly critical of the speaker, they clearly express they have no interest in calling a special session to change this law. And so with the speaker leaving office, this idea of changing the law really looks questionable at this point.
Here's a question for you, Dan. If a special session was called for a different purpose, you know, to deal with any of the things that we've talked about already, or guns in schools,
can't do that.
No,
the governor controls the agenda of a special session to the extent he can't specify, oh, I want you to consider this bill or that bill, but it's the topic. so he can limit the agenda of the special session by topic. And if he doesn't include, like, the Inland Port Board Authority on, if he called a special session for, let's say, gun legislation, the legislature does not have the power to come in and start considering inland port legislation.
Okay. George Pyle, Greg Hughes and his board membership, this land ownership provision, potential conflict of interest there, and then also the fact that he appointed himself and criticism he's receiving for that. I'm just teeing it up for you. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I mean, what they should do is have a special session and just repeal the law. It was a stupid law. Nobody wanted it except Greg Hughes. And even he, you know, when he got to the end of the day and he actually read it, and it was like, oh, my God, not that, because they just, you know, they put it together. They were talking about it for a while, but the bill that passed got put together on, like, the last night or the next to the last night of the session and, you know, went to one house, went back to the other house, and everybody passed it. And even the original sponsor at one point was saying, oh, whoa, wait a minute, this isn't what I had in mind. And it gave the board even more power vis-a-vis the city than was originally envisioned. Took more money away.
Environmental provisions.
And, you know, you sit out here and you look at the history of self-dealing and corporate interlock and all this stuff. And, you know, not having been in the room, not having been involved in any of the discussions, it just looks like they want to have a big development that can be dirty and ship coal and do all that kind of stuff. And they know that if they just left it to the city, that the city would be worried about that kind of stuff.
George Pyle sees an episode of The Wire going on.
Well, I will take issue with one of George's premises, mm-hmm. and that's that nobody supports this but Greg Hughes. That's not true. I mean, the governor very much supports this legislation. A lot of the business leaders do. They see this as a huge economic development project. So there's a tremendous amount of support in the political and business community for this. It's the details, I think, that are problematic.
Dan, we've talked about the Salt Lake City Council prohibiting, and this actually we did this last week. Salt Lake City Council said that they were prohibiting the mayor from suing over this inland port deal without their consent. Is there any movement on that front, as far as we know, of the city and the city council coming together and saying, you know what, now's the time to litigate this?
Well, no. I don't think there's any movement in that direction. And the mayor's office said she had no intention to sue. So she was fine with the council putting that prohibition in there, which is, you know, legally questionable whether the city council can prohibit the executive from
taking action like that.
Right. Yeah. That would be like the legislature saying the governor couldn't, take action in court through the attorney general's
but, and
office.
It's also, I mean, as hostile as I am to this whole idea of the state taking this away from the city for no reason, the state does have the power to do things like this. I mean, constitutionally, there's the federal government and there's the states, and all the cities, counties, and sewer districts are subservient to the state. And if the state passes a rule, passes a law that says that this is how we're going to manage X acres of dirt, they pretty much have the authority to do that. And unless there could be some showing that, unless there's some provision in the Utah Constitution or something that you can't treat cities differently than other cities or something like that, I don't think the mayor would have a lot of legs to stand on in court. This is would have to be more of a legislative political thing. And with the Republicans having all the power, you know, I don't see any other way around it either.
Dan, if they decide to move on this thing, if the state does, are we going to see massive construction happening really soon? I mean, will there be any further planning or public vetting of what's being planned?
That's an excellent question. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of folks that are very eager for this to happen. I think, you know, we're a ways down the road before you'd actually see anything built out there. But I don't know really what their public vetting plan is, you know, to tell you the truth. Like right now at the old prison property, they're going through this process of, you know, inviting public input and at least going through the process of trying to have the public have a say in what happens to that pretty crucial property in the South Valley. I would imagine they would do the same kind of thing with this port, but I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, they appoint a board, usually kind of The thought of having a board is that you will have meetings and you will have plans and you will have public comment periods. And I don't think that's laid out in the legislation, but that, you know, why have a board if you're not going to do things like that?
And it would be a public body that would be subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, we will count on you and your reporters to let us know what happens here, Dan. And thanks for this. We actually have to head to another quick break here. And when we come back, we will go to recommendations from a state commission on. It's behind the headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, what convinces people the climate is changing?
Only campaigns work. Only the repetition of simple messages changes public opinion and affects the brain.
We also learn why facts alone don't change minds.
Fact and reason and rationality have to be integrated with emotional intelligence.
Selling the science of climate change on the next Climate One.
Join us this morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
grilled peaches with burrata.
We always have a great time. So will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Join us Sunday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Thomas Burr, and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. The number is 801-355-8255. Before the break, I said we were going to head to a student safety commission or a commission on school safety. Actually, let's turn to San Juan County first, because there's some interesting stories out of there. Dan Harry, Willie Gray Eyes, the Democratic and Navajo candidate for San Juan County Commission, he was booted from the ballot. He filed suit against the county for that decision. And then there's this sort of broader context of a court-ordered redistricting that happened. Fertile ground for some reporting from the Tribune, and the Tribune's been covering it. What is happening in a nutshell in San Juan County? Maybe start with this suit that Willie Gray Eyes has filed against the county for having booted him.
Yeah, it's basically a claim that what has happened there is unconstitutional disfranchisement, not only of Willie Gray Eyes as a candidate, but of voters who would decide who the next commissioner will be down there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just looking at this from the outside, the bar for proving that somebody doesn't have residency in a place is an almost impossible bar to reach. I mean, how do you prove that someone doesn't live somewhere, especially if they have a house in the district that they claim to live in, and they've been a registered voter for, you know, decades? The idea that you'd send a deputy out and not find any tire tracks in the dirt driveway and found no one home.
And that would be enough.
And your neighbors would say, well, I don't really know him, or I haven't seen him around much, or I've heard through the grapevine that he lives in Arizona. That doesn't seem like meeting that high bar of disproving someone's residency.
And again, the county says that they kicked him off because he doesn't live there. He says, no, in fact, I do live here, and this is why he's filed this court case. I mean, this could be a really interesting court challenge. How quickly will it play out? I mean, the special election is...
It's got to play out before the election, right? Yeah. So under state law, the party, the Democratic Party, Willie Gray Eyes was their chosen nominee for that race, would have until, I think, third week of August to make a replacement candidate to get on the ballot. But they, right now, they have no intention of doing that. They want Willie Gray Eyes, who was nominated at their convention, to be the candidate. And so the courts will decide before that, I'm sure. There's also, simultaneously another lawsuit that was filed. This goes back to the original federal court decision that redivided the districts, the voting districts in San Juan County, Robert Shelby, the federal judge, ruled that the way that the districts were divided were unconstitutional. They deprived a population, being the Navajos, of fair representation. And so the court, after the county did not act to the court's satisfaction, the court came in with an expert who redrew districts. And the way that it ended up, there were three county commission seats there, and the districts now, two of them would be majority Navajo.
Right. This is part of the story is that Navajo candidates like Willie Gray Eyes would stand a great chance of being elected. I mean,
right.
Is that if you were reading into motivations for why you would want to disqualify Willie Gray Eyes? I mean, what I'm wondering is, have other candidates been vetted for their residency the way that he has?
It doesn't appear to be so. That what the county says is that we only initiate these investigations in response to a complaint, and we had a complaint against Willie Gray Eyes. The complaint, by the way, was filed by one of the Republican candidates that had not made it through the convention, but that's the county's response to that.
Well, and you mentioned that there's this other lawsuit that's been filed,
right.
Navajos who are saying that things, despite the court-ordered redistricting, they're not going well.
They claim that the county is now in contempt of the court, that they're not following what the judge said, that precincts haven't been reallocated, that the ballots are being improperly prepared, and that to them, they're claiming this looks like the county is flouting the order of the court. The county again claims, no, we are trying to implement this and we are following the law.
And so they're asking for the plaintiffs here are asking for the voting rights case that led to this redistricting originally to be reopened. What could that do? What would that lead to, I guess?
We're not sure at this point. I mean, the judge step in and make another order. I don't know what you do beyond that. I'm not sure how this all ends.
Right. George Pyle, doings in San Juan County. again, it's an interesting case down there. I mean, what do you see?
Well, Willie Gray Eyes has as much claim to live in San Juan County as Orrin Hatch has claimed to live in Utah. I mean, this is the way politics works. You could say that, you know, within the Navajo culture, there's not a whole lot of respect for the lines that Washington, D.C. drew on the map, and they're more concerned about the reservation, which spans at least two states, maybe three. And so you might get into a little bit of an argument as to about, you know, says who? Where is Utah? Where is Arizona? We don't care where Utah and Arizona are. We care where the reservation is. But yeah, I think it was really just tacky of the whoever made the complaint and the county to chase down this one guy who is obviously symbolic of the whole idea of the Navajo actually having some political power in an area where they are clearly the minority.
I wonder, is there any risk of, I mean, just from a politics standpoint, of sort of elevating his name or creating more of a profile for that candidate? I don't know. It helping him in a way by making him sort of a hero of this case. He would have to win the case, of course, first for that to happen. It's an interesting thing to sort of mull over. I don't know. Dan Harry, we will see how it plays out, I guess, in the end. I do want to turn. We have a couple of more stories to get to before we head to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And I did want to get back to the School Safety Commission. There was a panel of lawmakers and citizens who convened a commission, or was a commission was convened to look at school safety in the wake of the Parkland, Florida school shooting that happened. And they have come up with some recommendations that they're not exactly of a mind on all of the recommendations. But Dan, the headline here is that one of those suggestions is to allow law enforcement to confiscate guns in some circumstances. And in a state like Utah, where gun rights are cherished, that would seem kind of controversial. What is that provision of this recommendation?
Yeah, we saw a bill like this introduced late in the session earlier this year. And the idea is that it would be like a protective order where someone, you know, comes in and gets a protective order, say, against an abusive spouse. In this case, someone would go in and say, I have a family member, let's say it's my brother, he's a gun owner, he's got some mental issues, and I believe that he's a danger to not only himself, but to our family. And so you'd go to a court and try to get basically an order from a judge saying, yes, this person is dangerous enough that you cannot own guns, and we're going to at least temporarily, you know, remove the guns from your possession.
Extreme risk protective orders was the idea. And that didn't go so well in the legislative session.
Well, it was introduced late. This was after the Florida school shooting, and there were some, including Speaker Greg Hughes, who said, look, we need to do something. And this was kind of one of the bills that came forward, and there seemed to be some initial support behind the idea. The guy who introduced it, Steve Handy, is a Republican, and, pitching it as a common sense approach. Everybody, I think, would agree that if someone actually has some mental illness or has proven to be dangerous, that person probably shouldn't have guns. Mm-hmm. And so that was the idea behind it. It sort of fizzled because, again, there was so little time left in the legislature and they were dealing with so many other issues that it kind of got lost. Mm-hmm. But that's the number one recommendation from this commission, and they want to push that forward.
What other recommendations does this commission have?
Well,
I mean, there's a lot. It seems like actually quite a bit. And I know that there are three sort of tiers of recommendations, those that they expect are sort of most politically feasible, and then the other two tiers, which maybe aren't as feasible to get passed. And again, these would have to be passed in, yet again, a special session of the state legislature. And I think that there are differences of opinion also on the board, Dan, from what I understand.
There are. So that's kind of why there was this level of tiers. The ones that they could agree on were the most important, rose to the top. Others, I mean, if you get down through the tiers, you're talking about things like universal background checks, which is kind of hard to imagine seeing the Utah legislature pass that, given their history of pro-gun legislation. So some of it deals with school safety, trying to harden schools and bring them down to single access points. So I think the one bill about the, what is it, extreme danger?
Right, extreme risk.
Extreme risk is probably the one that we'll see introduced, and probably we'll see some votes taken on it.
And the governor seems to be in favor of having a special session or including this, I guess, in a special session that may get called. George Pyle, student safety.
Well, I think, it's really kind of commendable of this group to bring up a suggestion that would take one gun away from one person in the whole state. I mean, they've actually moved off the idea that everybody has a gun and that makes us all safer, which, of course, is bilge. You go back and you look at these instances and, not in every case, but in many cases, there's like, why did this person have guns? Wasn't there somebody around to tell somebody, this guy's a little off and he's been making threats and God, his Facebook page is full of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And you don't notice that until after he's shot 17 people. So this is a case where they can say, look, we believe in the Second Amendment. We believe in people that self-defense. Firearms, the right to self-defense, but not for absolutely everybody. There is a limit, and here's the limit. I was glad to see, too, that way down the list, that something that was supported by, one or two members, but not the whole board, was this idea basically of giving up, of saying we're a heavily armed society. Every weirdo in the place has an absolute right to have a gun. Therefore, we need to turn our schools into sort of reverse prisons where, they're armed camps and you only get in one door and you harden the schools. I'm sorry, if we get to a point where we have to harden our schools, we've basically given up on civilization. That's, so that people can have guns.
George Pyle, editorial voice at the Salt Lake Tribune. Guys, we have run up against the end of the show, and so Dan, just quickly before we go to our underplayed stories of the week, can you tell us when we might see a special session of the legislature? Just sometime between now and January, I guess. Is there a time frame for it?
Usually, they do this. They try to do it on interim days, you know, which is usually the third Wednesday of a month. I don't know. That seems like something that would be. They try to keep a special session usually to one day, and it seems like this issue is not a one-day issue. So I don't know. They may do it. I also could see them waiting until January to try to introduce this legislation. So we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, well, it's time now for our underplayed stories of the week. Maybe stories that didn't get the same coverage or were surprising to you in some way or another. I'm going to actually start with Thomas Burr in Washington, D.C., since he's been waiting on the line this patiently this whole hour. Tommy, what's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, so amid the backdrop of children being ripped from their parents' arms at the U.S.-Mexico border, I just found this fascinating, and I don't think it got much play. But the Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen and the White House senior advisor, Stephen Miller, who is kind of the architect behind the zero tolerance policy, both went separately to Mexican restaurants here in Washington this week, and were heckled, of course, at the Mexican restaurants. So maybe there's a little bit of tone deafness at the White House this day.
Right, to the point of being sort of chased out of these restaurants, in fact, by protesters. Interesting.
Which is fine in one of the cases because the tacos are really horrible at one of them.
Tommy knows. All right, Tommy's pick for underplayed story. George Pyle, your pick.
Well, among the things that came up while we were looking at other things, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday, 5-4, that states can charge sales tax to online businesses. I mean, there's some limits, some minimums you have to hit. But the idea that the online commerce is some tender reed that needs all kinds of protection is over, because online commerce is where it is. It's stronger than brick and mortar commerce. And our legislator, our governor particularly, has been saying for a long time, why is our economy way up and our sales tax take flat to down? It's because people are buying stuff online and not paying sales tax. Now there's a real chance that the state will get the sales tax revenue it's been missing. And when you understand that the tax is paid by consumers, not businesses, the tax is owed by consumers, not businesses, then you get to the realization that we should have been paying this tax all along.
George, it's a great pick for an underplayed story. Dan Harry, your pick.
Speaking of taxes, we will soon see another sales tax increase in Salt Lake County because of an odd formula that was used to let city councils vote on this sales tax increase for transportation, roads, and transit. And if cities representing 67% of the population passed it, it will be imposed, and they did. So without a vote of the people, this is the same legislation that was defeated at the ballot 3 years ago.
All right. Great pick for underplayed story of the week. I'm going to forego mine. Actually, George, you stole my pick for underplayed story of the week.
We got to get our act together.
I know. We got to coordinate. Dan Harry, George Pyle, Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and also to the show's producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll see you next week.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, so this is exciting. Lead singer of Led Zeppelin, music icon, the prototypical rock star, Robert Plant. And sure, he's all those things, but Robert Plant is also a kind, warm, giving person with a lot of perspective on life. It's coming up on Q from PRI or Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.